That music means it's time for DLC, your downloadable content for the week. DLC delivered the way it's meant to be, completely free. And that's thanks to our sponsor this week, MailChimp. They're the ones that made that possible, bringing the show to you completely free. DLC, of course, is the show all about gaming in its many forms. Games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles, and also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I am your host, Jeff 2N1T Kanata, and I'm joined as always by my friend slash co-host slash nemesis. The guy who joins me on this Memorial Day in thanking all of the brave men and women, past and present, who have served our country and continue to do so. Christian Spicer, welcome.
I'm sorry, who are you? I don't remember anything that happened after the mid-1970s.
Not that kind of memory day. It's Memorial Day.
No, yes. Heartfelt thank you to those soldiers that have fallen defending in the line of duty for the United States military and their families that carry their legacy forward today.
And those that are currently serving. I know we have some listeners that are our current military servicemen men and women, and we salute them and really are grateful for their service.
We salute them every day, but that's indeed not what Memorial Day is about, bro.
Well, we also, DLC, of course, is your downloadable Kanata, your downloadable Christian. But today, DLC stands for Debate Loves Company, and we have pretty much our favorite company of all. Three-time aww, DLC returning champion, Garnett Lee. Hello, Garnett.
I think it's four.
Is it four?
I think it might be four.
Oh, you're close to your five timers club card.
I know. I'm gonna get the jacket, and any minute now, Steve Martin will be hanging out with me, and we'll be in the green room.
Garnett, of course, is from Garnett on Games, his awesome show on iTunes and everywhere you get downloadable awesome things, and a show called John Plus Garnett, which I think the full title is John Plus Garnett and Never Jeff. I'm pretty sure that's the full title of that show. But both excellent, excellent video gaming shows that
we
you should
could,
listen to.
We could
to
make it a video game three-way.
I think we should, man.
That sounds begging like the perfect amount of people. Just three people. Great. All right, let's keep going.
All right. We have, it's Memorial Day. We're getting together. We're talking about games. And, we're in the pre-E3 time. So there's not a ton of news. I think today is.
Oh yeah, Can we just not do the fluff train, though? Of like video games that are like barbecues.
How are video games like?
I'm going to compare video games that are like barbecues that are like Game of Thrones characters.
Yes, exactly. Any of these silly fuff stuff that you get.
Oh, I get you. Yeah, so I think today's going to be. It's going to be a show heavy on stuff we've been playing in the playlist because we've all been playing really awesome things. So we won't spend too much time with news, but we do have to start the show, as always, with Story of the Week.
Story of the Week, it's the Story of the Week. Story of the Week, it's the Story of the Week.
Story of the Week, of course, the segment of the show where we try to convince one another what the most important story that happened in the world of gaming this week was. Garnett, I'm curious, what do you think the most important story was this week?
I think the most important story this week is... you see, I've been struggling with this because, like you said, it hasn't been a ton of news out there. Mm-hmm. I think the E3 anticipation is running high, but the story of the week would be early release at some mom-and-pop shops for Watch Dogs and the wildly variable response that people are having to that game. It is all over the board.
We are talking here on Watch Dogs Eve. So I assume we'll be talking lots about that game next week, but tell me about your take on this, this is a game that is carrying the mantle of next gen on its back, right? So there's going to be a lot of, I think, wild diversity in the response to it.
See, I think that right there exactly highlights the problem, because it should not be carrying next gen on its back. It's not a true next-gen game. It's a hybrid game. It's on the Assassin's Creed 3 engine. And I think it's really interesting how, you know, people and Ubisoft did this to themselves. They backed themselves into this corner by the way they set it up to be the savior of next-gen. So it's the biggest example we've had of a game that comes out with a, you know, super amazing trailer. It's going to be, how is it ever going to live up to that? Well, that trailer happened to coincide perfectly with the time that we were just getting next-gen hype. So everyone said, oh, it's going to be a next-gen game, and this is what things are going to look like. And then quietly, of course, they go and make the game on the Assassin's Creed 3 engine. Somewhere during that process, who knows how the game was originally intended to be, but based off what we saw early on versus now, they certainly decided we need to Grand Theft Auto-ify this game quite a bit. So they added, you know, a whole lot of the driving, and they get that sort of, you know, Grand Theft Auto in Chicago feel to the game. And now it arrives, and people's expectations, it's just they're so high. And also there's a tremendous amount of pent-up desire for next-gen games. Look at how well, and this is not, and I know, Christian, you loved Infamous, and I think, Jeff, you liked Infamous very well. But as Infamous did exceedingly well, and I think that it shows, and I'm talking about sales, and I think that really illustrates how much people really, really wanted to have a great next-gen experience on their next-gen consoles, right?
Yes.
And so when you now get this game, which is open world, which already strains the limits of an engine, and you find out, oh, well, they built it on the framework of an Assassin's Creed 3 engine that's, you know, a little bit older. Granted, it has the ability to straddle the old gen and the new gen. Man, I just think it's set itself up for some of the emotional negative responses. But then what's really interesting is over the weekend, you started to see people who initially had emotional negative responses to it because they're like, oh, it doesn't look like what I wanted it to be, or it's not that great. And then, oh, but you know what? Once I get into it, the story starts to get good around the second chapter, and I'm having fun with the game in single player. There's definitely some questions. I think one of the most curious things to see how it works out in the week ahead will be the whole invasion thing. Because if you haven't, you know, gotten up on that, when you're playing the game, you have to decide whether or not you want to play in a connected state or an unconnected state. And you earn reputation. And if you change the state in which you're playing, then you lose the reputation that you've earned. So if you turn on the game and you're playing in a connected state and you're earning reputation, you decide, well, I don't want to be invaded anymore. I'm fed up with people hacking into my game. Then when you disable that, you lose the reputation you've earned.
Wow.
And it's going to be really curious to see how much that interrupts people's playing of the game. Now, they have built into the game a system where when you are in a critical mission, the invasion system turns off. So I think it remains to be seen how much it really makes a big deal, because, you know, if you're just fiddling around in the city, and then does it actually add to that immersive nature to have people invading you? And does it actually turn off effectively when you go into the missions? You know, their whole thing is when you're playing something that's important to not be interrupted, we're not going to let people interrupt you.
Right.
But, you know.
Well, we got a few different things going on here, and I want to kind of parse it out a little bit, because I haven't been playing the game yet. I'll be getting it tomorrow like everybody else, and excited to try it out. But I think the issue that you brought up that's more relevant to what we can talk about today is this idea of you know, we have somebody in the chat room here, Handers, said, no games ever live up to trailers. And the idea of marketing game and making it seem like the next big thing, and then when it comes close to coming out, it's like, well, it can't be the next big thing. It's got to be in context with all the other things that are big right now. Is there a disparity between expectation and delivery? And is it unfair to kind of hold these games up to that kind of standard if the marketing team themselves created that?
Exactly. That's the key, Jeff, is that last part is, I think, yes, it's unfair to hold games up as like the second coming of, or like the ushering in the new era, on, you know, when fans give games those expectations. But when, you know, Ubisoft comes with this trailer and starts like really getting this hype train choo-choo going, it's hard. They can't then be upset when people buy into it. And then when they feel like it under delivers that hype, It's the really narrow ledge that you walk on between trying to get your game hyped and get everybody talking about it and get all the sites to cover it and podcasts to talk about it. And then not being like, well, guys, you guys are overreacting. It's just a video. You know what I mean? It's really delicate. And I think Watch Dogs may have messed up. And I think maybe Ubisoft realized that. And with these, you know, the rumored even further delay of The Division, where it's like, oh, crap, we did it again.
Yeah.
I mean, it's tough.
Well, there's no doubt the delays are going to impact those emotional responses as well, right? Because we all wanted Watch Dogs to be one of the darlings of last holiday. And here it is, you know, a couple of weeks before E3, and we're finally getting the game. And we feel like we're, and especially those of us who are gamers, we feel like we're well into the next gen now.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't know how big of a feeling that is across the majority of people who play games. Like, if I got this game, and if I don't have a next gen system yet, and I go out and get Watch Dogs for my PS3 or my 360, I imagine I'd be pretty happy with it. And I'm actually very hopeful I'm going to be happy with it on my PS4. I'm just trying to, you know, parse out how to set my expectations. Then on the other hand, Christian, to what you were talking about, would you rather be overhyped or would you rather be a Wolfenstein, which I think, you know, a lot of us were not, you know, I think maybe after the last big demo round that they did, everyone was sort of raising the flag and going, hey, this game is going to be really good, but it didn't have anywhere near the hype around it that Watch Dogs has. But will it ultimately be as successful? I mean, obviously, we love it. I mean, we love it. I mean, lots of people have said how much fun it is.
Yeah, I mean, sales successful? No, I don't think it will. I think part of that is, you know, it is the marketing and the presence that the game has. I mean, Watch Dogs, I've seen commercials for it on television. I think part of it is, too, for better or worse, Wolfenstein, while a recognized brand, is maybe a stale brand and has had some games that maybe haven't been as great as people expected, or they still think it's, you know, this really old id, the very first popular first person shooter type game.
Your mouth, Wolfenstein multiplayer was awesome.
Right. So, well, that's how you know that it didn't live up to some people's expectations, is that when someone says that, the defender needs to step up and be like, shut your mouth, it was amazing. You never have that happen with a game that's universally praised. Right. I think, and this flew by me in the chat, so pardon for not giving credit, but the delay, I wonder how much that affected the Watch Dogs planned hype train, right? Because I think had it come out, there we go, Garnet, like you said, you know, at launch, I feel like maybe their marketing and their hype was perfect. Like, we were ready for it, and people had, you know, bought a console or pre-ordered their console for that game, and then now they missed that mark. Hopefully to make the game better. And now it's just at a point where all people are doing is looking for a reason to pick it apart. And so it's in that, oh, well, you missed your mark, and oh, it doesn't look as good, and oh, now I'm not excited about it. Oh, Infamous was amazing, or Titanfall's the best, and oh, well, this is just a GTA clone. And it's, you know, I wonder if their PR plan took that into account. I don't think, it appears that it didn't, that they really led up to a release, and then they're like, oh, crap. Yeah. And then they retooled their plan.
Well, rather than talking about marketing strategy, I'm interested in the chat here. Sir Desmond says there are definitely games that live up to their trailers. Typically, though, those trailers just aren't all that memorable because they didn't create a false expectation. What do you guys think about that? I don't feel, I guess that movies run into the same problem, but movies tend to be grabbing chunks from the actual film and showing you that, whereas video game trailers often are showing you something that is supposed to generate the feeling of playing it rather than actually showing you chunks of the game. Do you think that there's this problem of creating a false expectation of what the game even is because these trailers are have the responsibility to sell the game and therefore have to make it seem like the best thing ever? What do you think about that, Garnet?
I almost think that was a rhetorical comment.
Why?
You follow what I'm saying?
What do you mean? No, I don't.
We seem to be drawn. It's very human nature that we, as fans of our hobby, get drawn in by these videos, right? I mean, coming up in a couple of weeks, we'll be watching gobs of videos,
right?
And it's easy to get really drawn in by them, and yet at the same time, that is their sole purpose, and their sole purpose is really marketing. I mean, they are even more. Jeff, I know you have a real hang up with movie trailers, right?
I do. I avoid them like the plague.
Because movie trailers spoil the movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have a similar hang up with video game trailers, do you?
I tend not to. No, that's true.
And why is that? Out of curiosity.
I think it's kind of what I mentioned before, whereas a movie trailer is showing you actual clips from the experience that you're going to have, and often is trying to tell you the three acts of the story in their entirety. A video game trailer is often just giving you this sense of what it's going to feel like, and is often not spoiling specific moments in the game. So I tend not to watch actual gameplay moments or things. If there's a game I'm excited about, I don't tend to watch, you know, let's plays of it or whatever. So in that sense, it's analogous, but I'll watch a CG debut trailer because I know it's not really going to, it's just giving me a flavor. It's not showing me the exact experience I'm going to have.
And so maybe you're able to make that differentiation, but I was watching television. I think I was watching one of the NBA games, and they had a Watch Dogs. They had that Watch Dogs ad on, and the ad is entirely CG.
Right.
And it looks, you know, ridiculously amazing. And that's marketing's job.
Right.
But there's no way that anyone gets home with that game and sees that and says, oh, this is what I saw in the advertisement, because it's not what you see in the advertisement.
Right.
But if you're not a regular consumer of, you know, video game sites and trailers and all that kind of stuff, that's going to be disappointing. And the marketer at that point really doesn't care because you bought the game.
Yeah. Well, that's the marketer's job.
Exactly.
Yeah. We got a bunch of people on the line. You can call in and participate in this show at 512-518-5714 if you're listening live on Mondays at 11 a.m. Pacific time. Again, 512-518-5714. I kind of just wanted to jump into the calls and see what other people have to say. We got a call from 312 area code. What's your take on this? Do you feel like game trailers create a false expectation? And are you often disappointed when you... Also, tell us your name and where you're calling from.
This is Dom from Chicago. Big fan of all of you guys.
Thanks.
Oh, my gosh. Is your city being run ravaged by a guy hacking everything? Get out of there. Get out of Chicago while you still can.
Not yet. I haven't seen it. It is Memorial Day, though, so who knows. But, actually, you know, Jeff, I agree with you wholeheartedly on this one. I don't watch videos of gameplay. When I'm excited about the game, I want to put it into the system and really have it be revealed to me that first time. And that's what gets me excited about the game. I think all the marketing stuff, all the hype, I don't mind that because it doesn't ruin it. It gets me excited. I obviously realize the CG is not going to be, the graphics are not going to look like the CG content. And I want to know about the story, and I want to know about those other hooks and things that make the game interesting. So I like it. And actually, I don't know. Like, I thought Titanfall pretty much did live up to the hype. I'm a big, big time Titanfall fan. And I don't know. I think that's just a recent example of a game that lived up to the hype.
Yeah. That's a good comment, especially because he agreed with me. But, you know, I think this is an ongoing issue that is going to be even more true, as you said, Garnet, as we get into E3 week, where the entire job of all these companies is to show you stuff that's not available yet, but that's going to get you excited. So.
Do you remember, I mean, I'm assuming both of you do, but like old NES games, I feel like, you know, the very, very first round, like Super Mario Brothers, it had on the box art was a picture of a blown up picture of pixelated graphics and Excitebike. And then it slowly started becoming this awesome art. You know what I mean? Is that like the first example of that bait and switch CG trailer where you weren't getting the front of the box was this awesome fantasy picture of this amazing dragon?
No, man. I mean, every arcade cabinet in the 80s had drawings on it that weren't pictures from the game, you know.
Well, I mean, sure, but if you look at the game is sitting there playing.
Yeah, well, that's true. But I mean, I think there's always been this idea of, yeah, those three pixels are supposed to be an alien, and here's what the alien looks like in your imagination, and the sad little Atari 2600 can't create that, but imagine it. You know. Anyway, let's keep moving on, because I want to get to all the stuff we've been playing, including Wolfenstein and stuff. So, Christian, tell me what your story of the week is.
My story of the week is the news that PlayStation is coming to China with they're kind of doing two joint ventures to market the console and the games. They haven't explicitly said, at least that I've read yet, that it's going to be the PlayStation 4, but that's kind of what's rumored. And to do it legally, I know consoles have been there in the gray market for years, but legally the rules now that open up, it has to be, you know, a joint partnership, and partly at least manufactured, I believe, or something in China. And so now with Sony doing this, the big three are all set to introduce consoles in China, which, I mean, talk about has the potential to, who cares about, you know, Microsoft's like, oh, who cares about the Japanese market? We don't get our numbers from there. If console gaming in China takes off, who cares about the American market? Because no one's going to win the console war in America when you have the Chinese market sitting over there, right? Like, it's interesting.
Certainly a lot more people. Yeah.
Yeah, they're all jumping in. And Nintendo has said they're introducing, I think it was quote unquote, new hardware. I believe Microsoft has said it is the Xbox One they plan to bring there. And now PlayStation jumping on board. I think it's fascinating. It's the, especially if they're a little different consoles, because people talked about Xbox One. One of the reasons maybe they dropped Kinect is because of the cost of localizing voice commands for the international market. It realized it was more than they thought, that along with other factors. So are you going to have slightly different SKUs in these markets? Stuff like that. I was a political science major in college. No big deal. it's interesting, though. I think it's really interesting.
Yeah. I don't know how much I have more to add to that. Anything you wanted to say, Garnet?
Any discussion about the Chinese market has to include the rampant piracy that goes on there.
Well, sure, yeah.
And the
that's Assassin's Creed 4, for sure. It's a good game.
And the cloning of both software and hardware that takes place in that market. So I get the volume argument that you make, Christian. I'm not sure that the actual place is as much of a, you know, market panacea as you make it out to be.
Well, so you're saying there's going to be a bunch of people buying the fun location 4 in China?
I think that's certainly a potentiality.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's what's interesting about it, though. I mean, now all big three console manufacturers have decided that it is worth it to them. I mean, they're not aware of that.
It's definitely worth it to them. I'm just not sure it'll be the ultimate battleground. And then also you have to, you know, build in that they will do a lot of, you know, cultural localization. And I think that there'll be especially, you know, a tremendous amount of software specifically tailored to the market.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, that's, I mean, not a huge hot button discussion topic per se, but yeah. I think it's a big story.
It's of note.
My story of the week.
Certainly of note. Mine is this report from Gamasutra that Steam has already had more releases in the first half of 2014 than in all of 2013. And that if it continues at this pace, we'll see more than 2,000 new games released on Steam this calendar year, compared to only 600 in 2013.
But the drought, though. The game drought.
So I think this has ramifications in a whole number of ways. They have a quote in the Gamasutra article from a PR guy saying that it's approaching iOS App Store levels of saturation, and that it's really difficult for some of these games to break out and have any kind of chance to sell well, that there's just such a glut of games. You know, it's a double-edged sword, right? Because there's tons of amazing things to play. There's lots of access for small developers to get their games onto Steam and in the Greenlight program and in the early access program, you get a chance to see all these things bubbling up. But there's a lot of bubbles that never make it to the top. So what's your guys' feeling on that? Garnet, what do you think about this? You're a guy who worked in publishing, especially in app publishing. It's tough to get games out there when there's so many, right?
It is absolutely a legitimate concern. And until someone cracks the curation issue that plagues iTunes and now will begin to plague Steam. It has exactly the effect that you're describing of making it very difficult for good games to find their way forward into people's consciousness. It's just super challenging. And I honestly don't have a magic wand to wave and tell you, oh, I have a solution, because I don't have a solution for it right now. And I don't think that the answer would ever be to say, oh, we'll have fewer releases, because no one wants fewer releases, right? I mean, that doesn't make any sense. But we do want a way that when there's a great game that it gets in front of us, and not just the random great game. I mean, there are going to be a number of good games and potentially even great games that find only a connection with the smaller, you know, niche market that really loves them and found them, as opposed to getting to the bigger market that they really deserve. And a lot of people who would really enjoy them won't find them.
Yeah, it's tough, because we're basically saying, oh my gosh, there's too much of a good thing. But it's just unfortunate that these guys that are slaving away and making really wonderful content will have a much more difficult time finding an audience. What do you think, Christian?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what both you and Garnet said, Jeff, but I also think another problem, I think for me, the fear isn't there's too much of a good thing. The fear is there's too much crap and not enough of a good thing, or the good thing, my fear is, gets lost in the shuffle. Like, I've pretty much given up on iOS gaming unless I hear about it, you know, from friends, or it enough people really start making noise about it. Because I used
unless
to.
Unless it has Flappy in the title.
Right. Well, duh. I mean, I was an early iPhone guy, and I used to, you know, whenever it was, I already forget, Monday or Tuesday, you know, I would go into the iOS store and look at the new games, the new apps and whatever. And now it's just, they all have Flappy in the title, and there's just so much junk. And now Steam, it's great. It really is great that more, you know, individuals or publishers and companies are able to get their games on the Steam store. But man, going in there is it's a pain. It's so tough. But then, you know, like Garnet was talking about, curating is great, except curating to one person is, you know, forcing your will, you know, to another person, right? Where it's like, I don't like first-person shooters, so I curate only Papers, Please, Gone Home, whatever, like that, Thomas Was Alone, all great games. But then it's like, if you're a fan of Wolfenstein, you'll never see it, and then you're upset. And then I don't know what the answer is, other than hopefully, you know, the market will work at some point. I just don't think you can maintain this. I was going to say, there's a word that starts with cluster, in these stores. I mean, imagine, it's like going, if you walked into GameStop or your Best Buy, and instead of it being the manageable mess that it is, it's all of a sudden like the awesome flea market on Sunday, where you might be able to find an unopened Sports Friends or whatever, right, for Nintendo. But chances are you're just never going to see it, because it's just piles of crap. And that, I don't like getting anxious when I open up a digital storefront to look for a game.
What about the idea, though, of Steam having, you know, user-curated storefronts, so you could have, you know, a set of friends, and you know, oh, well, I know Christian likes Infamous and that sort of game, so I'll look at his curated collection for that sort of stuff.
I think it's a fascinating thought study, or even something to implement, but unfortunately, it's kind of like, I think, Jeff, you and I have joked about this, where, oh, it's thundering, where I say ooh, because I'm in Texas right now. It doesn't thunder in California, you guys. That's why I'm impressed by it. I never rate anything on Yelp, but when I'm in a new city, I'm like, let's find a good place to get a burrito. Let me check Yelp. So it's like this weird problem of like curated stores, but would I take the time to create one? Like, you can already rate games on Steam, right? I've never done that. Maybe I'm part of the problem. Like, if I would rate the games I like, maybe they'd bubble to the top. But then you're putting the onus on the user to help surface games, and I want to play games. I don't want to make them in Little Big Planet, and I don't want to curate them in Steam. I want to play them.
Remember, you can submit stories for us to consider for Story of the Week with the hashtag DLCSOTW. I want to hit on a couple of other stories that have been submitted this week. At Dan Pack, PAQ, submitted the story about Mario Kart 8 coming with a free Wii U game if you buy it. It's kind of cool. You can get Pikmin 3, New Super Mario Bros. U, Legend of Zelda Wind Waker HD, or Wii U Party if you buy Mario Kart 8. I've been playing a bunch of Mario Kart 8, and it's really solid game. And the fact that they give you an extra Wii U game is pretty much makes it a must-buy for Wii U owners. Pretty good. Any comments on that?
Dude, Pikmin 3 for free? I mean...
Yeah, well, any of these.
That is a fantastic deal right there. I mean, the other games are really nice, too. Pikmin 3 is on my I want to play this game when I have a Wii U list. So yeah. That's immediately a wow. I'd totally be into that.
Yeah, I don't think it'll get anyone to buy a Wii U, but if you have, it's awesome. Like, that's fantastic. It's hard to complain. They're downloadable from, you know, the shop or whatever, but still, they're pretty good games. Some of the better games on the Wii U, you get one for free. That's great. That's fantastic.
Yeah, at Black Symbiote submitted the story about Amplitude meeting its Kickstarter goal, even though it was in a very abbreviated time period. They got $844,000, and they were doing it with really fun streams toward the end. So I guess Amplitude's going to get made. I know that these guys had a very small window in which to raise funds to even make that game. And I think as fans of the old Amplitude, I think all of us are excited. And Garnet, do you have any thoughts on that?
As a game or as a Kickstarter experiment?
Well, either one. You take the pick. Dealer's choice.
Well, I think as a game, I'm of course excited for it because, you know, I love music games. I loved Amplitude and Frequency. I think that they were, you know, obviously the pioneers by the same company who wound up doing a lot of the music highway games. And highway games just means, you know, a game where you're listening to music and there's a roadway in the screen that has gems laid on it, and you know touch them with some form of controller interaction on beat. And Frequency and Amplitude were fantastic. I think they really got the connection with the music because you were, in essence, building the tracks and putting them together to flush out the whole, you know, entire song, which was really cool. It was a really great and fun game. And I think part of that is nostalgia because it was a while ago. But I remember tremendously enjoying it. And so I'm thinking, wow, this on PS4 will be a really cool experience. And I'm into that. The Kickstarter thing is... Well, there's a lot of lessons to be learned from this Kickstarter. And, you know, I drew some ire when near the end of the campaign, I said, hey, you know, I'm starting to almost feel a little bit uncomfortable because, and granted, they had to go on the full attack. I mean, they looked like they were in a position where it wasn't going to be successfully funded. Let's be honest. Right. They had a okay start. They got up in around the, you know, like the $250,000 range, but they had a long, I mean, they were only a 18 day run that they did?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was really short.
It was a fairly short run. And so they, you know, they had a good liftoff, but then they were relatively flat right up until about 3 days before the thing was going to finish. And I'm sure that they had, you know, put in place a contingency plan of how are we going to deal with that? And the contingency plan was that they did a big full court press, and a lot of those things were cool. You know, they did like a stream where they were pretty funny. There was pretty, their stream was really cool. You know, they got on there with the band that they travel around with for Rock Band, and they did like requests. I mean, at one point they even like played, they like ad-lib played the theme from Home Improvement, which was pretty much hilarious. I loved that. What got to me though was just the constant push of hey, 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 contribute, contribute, contribute. If you've already contributed, up your contribution. I get that at some point for me, it sort of transitioned from something that I felt really good about and excited and passionate about. Oh, I really want to see this game, to almost like being at the back part of the state fair where they're selling you Ginsu knives.
Yeah.
And it worries me. It worries me to think about game production moving into that space, because on top of everything else, I don't want my creators to be in such hard positions that they have to go and do that. And I applaud them. I mean, I'm glad that they made it. I'm excited that they made it. I felt horrible that they had to be the barker standing up there inside the box trying to get the housewives to stop and check out their kitchen utensil demo.
But that's sort of that's the deal, you know. That's sort of the deal.
I guess it's interesting. The chat room is with Kickstarter.
Yeah, Well, the chat room is agreeing with you a lot, Garnet.
One of the challenges when you are on a single platform.
Yeah.
You know, their market for the game is only PlayStation. And I think that, you know, though we're all really excited about what Sony has done in the indie space with all of the efforts they've made on PlayStation 4, obviously there are fantastic games already out and many ones that we're excited about coming. What real impact has that had? And as an indie game, can you really be sustained simply being on one platform like that?
I think that's the big challenge. There's a lot of support for what you're saying in the chat room, which is interesting to me. Someone even mentioned that it felt like the game was being held hostage, that the hardcore fans were sort of on the hook to fund the game. And it was like, oh, this franchise is being held hostage and you gotta step up and save it.
You know what? That's actually a really good point. And that hadn't clicked, but there were a couple of emails that came out, you know, from them where it was like, hey, you've contributed, but contribute more.
Yeah.
And they came with bonuses, but at the same time I was like, hey, you know, I'm in, and I'm in with what I can afford to contribute. And you know,
yeah,
I don't know.
That's, by the way, that was Red Sky in the chat room. Thanks for that comment. Yeah. Interesting stuff. All right, guys, let's move on. And, we got to do the thing that we are moving toward E3 inside, and that is the hype train. There you go. Christian is the conductor of the hype train. So, Christian, what's the E3 question that we're going to be predicting the answer to this week?
What percentage of games showed or debuted at this year's show will be playable on the show floor?
Well, there's always going to be a big percentage. There's going to be a very large number of games playable on the show floor. Is it going to be the games that everybody's talking about? I say no. there's going to be a whole bunch of games playable. I don't know how you can do a percentage, but
debuted at this year, though.
Debuted? This is going to be the E3 of 2015. This is going to be the E3 of promises. This is going to be the E3 of these boxes are going to do some amazing stuff if you just wait about a year. I think that's going to be few games that are actually in a playable state, but there's going to be a lot of really big promises for 2015.
So the backside of that question is, will you be able to go hands-on with the game that you're most hyped for at this year's E3? It sounds like your prediction is no. The game that you are most hyped for that's shown at... Yeah, isn't. I think no also, but I really hope it's yes. I really hope it's, Quantic Dream, something. There's possibilities out there. Imagine if we could play Last Guardian. Oh, my goodness. I would explode. That'd be amazing, right? It'd be amazing.
Imagine and Last Guardian, two words that go great together.
Yeah.
What do you think, Garnet?
Well, I mean, if we're sticking hard to the idea of games announced that we had not heard of prior to this and how many will be playable, I'm almost inclined to say, I mean, I like whoever it was in the chat room already scrolled off the top of the screen that said, Kaja is right. Can I just bet the dollar price is right style? Because I think that is absolutely correct. I'll go 10% because I think that most of everything that is being debuted as new stuff that you didn't know about will be debuted as trailers. There might be one or two games that are surprise fall insertions. And if they are, I would guess that they will either be series extensions, you know, like a 3 or a 4 or 5 or whatever that have already been baking, or HD up versions. But I think there's still, you know, a number of HD up versions to come, right? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Does anyone doubt that, among other things, that there'll be the inevitable reveal of Grand Theft Auto HD or whatever they're going to call it? Next gen, something. I guess it's already HD, so it'll be Grand Theft Auto next update. That's got to be there. Does that count, Christian?
If that's what you're most hype, I mean, I guess.
I mean, does that count as a game that would be announced? I mean, you see what I'm saying? Is like, that's a game that would be technically maybe announced. And I think if it was, it would be playable. But is it really a new game being announced?
Yeah, you can define it how you want. Yeah, I would say that, yes, technically it is, just because it's been rumored. I mean, it's kind of like the Halo, you know, Master Chief Legacy If they officially announce it and have it playable, I think that counts. Sure, why not? I think definitive edition.
If that counts, then I'll up it to about 20 or 25%, because I think that there will be some things like that, because all of the, you know, all of the consoles need to have some content for the holiday that we don't really know about. But I think that it'll be more of that sort of thing. I don't think you're going to get a, oh my God, this new IP is coming and you're going to play it this fall.
Well, I think it kind of relates back to our discussion that we had at the beginning of the show with Watch Dogs, is that now the PR plan for these big games, it has tent poles in it. It says, okay, at E3, we announce the title. And at, you know, and then at whatever PAX, we show a trailer. And then at whatever else, we, you know, show you the character designs. And then, you know, it's like a 2-year plan leading up to release, and it builds
and then
this.
At the next E3, we delay the title.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so well, I think there are very few games. It happens every now and again. I mean, we saw that happen with Civilization Beyond Earth, which was announced and was immediately playable in just a few weeks. So it does happen. It's just much more rare now, I would say.
Yeah, I was going to say, Far Cry 4 could maybe be that game. Like, it was announced pre-E3 in the investors call, but that's out this year, and that could be playable, and that could be amazing. Far Cry 3 was amazing.
I agree.
But that's announced.
Yeah, that is already announced. It doesn't fit your criteria, yeah, but I also agree that it'll be.
I'm gonna give you a piece of E3 thing for me that is going to potentially leave you scratching your head, or maybe at least maybe thinking about what I'm saying. I've actually reached a weird point. And granted, I know that this, a lot of people say, well, that's because you've been to so many E3s and, you know, you've already got all that. You've had that experience. But it's more than that. I am losing, or I've almost completely lost interest in the hands-on demo. And I really am, if anything, it's part of a bigger thing that's happening where I'm much more interested in the games that are coming out now that I can play and sit down and play and enjoy, than getting excited for stuff that is months or maybe even years away in the future. Because I found that now that I'm starting to think about it, it's like, oh, you know what? All that stuff that I get hype about, not only is it a distraction, but it's inevitable that when I go to play what's out now, I find myself thinking about what's going to be coming out and going, oh, well, you know, why am I playing Watch Dogs? Because what I really want to play is Division. Well, no, what I really want to play is Watch Dogs, which is what I'm playing right now.
And no, I want to play Watch Dogs last year.
But you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Right. And so rather than being excited about it then, what I want to do, I'm making a conscious decision that I'm going to start moving my emotional interest in games to what's out now and talking about it and maybe actually putting, you know, my money, so to say, where my mouth is. Because for years, even going back to 1UP, we talked about how, oh, you know what, we should spend more time covering games that come out because they come out and then we just sort of forget about them. But we'll spend, you know, totally massive amounts of time on games prior to their release. But then they come out and it's like, then they're gone. I mean, like Arcast Studios just said right there, enjoy the present. And I want to live in the now. I want to enjoy the present. I want to be much more engaged in the games that I'm playing now and let the games that are coming, let them do their thing. And the other part of it is that all of these demos have become so incredibly practiced and you know, they are constructed with such a plan of attack going in that I don't really need to play the damn game because I can watch someone play it and I'll know exactly what that experience is because the designers designed that little demo experience that a person has so particularly, so exactingly, that there's only one experience you're going to have out of it anyway.
Garnet Lee's live in the now. I love it.
Hey, Garnet, this is Mark from marketing, and shut up. Thanks so much. We're trying to sell some games here. And so I think we might have something coming out in the next 6 months you might really, really like. It's a JRPG where you play as a girl that's a music-based game. Anyway, it's coming soon. Get excited. And just shut up. Okay, thanks. All right, back to you guys. Hey,
Mark,
great podcast.
You know, this, I mean, and also I think this right here points to exactly why like, okay, why A, conversations like this are so awesome, and B, even more so, why Twitch is so good. I mean, this is why we love Twitch, is because it is in the now. It is what's real. It's like, hey, we're playing these games. Let's play this game. Let's check it out. Let's have fun with it. Let's talk about it. Let's have the water cooler conversations. Let's not only have the water cooler conversation, but let's have the water cooler conversation in the chat while someone is playing the game and we can all hang out together. It's awesome.
No, totally. And I think even going back and you, you know, as a listener to you and John, you know, you guys talk about even older games. I think that's great. Like since I've bought a 2DS and I'm no longer sharing that system with anyone, you know, I've started going back into Super Mario 3D Land, which I played for a little bit and then moved on. And yeah, there is, anytime people complain about the drought in games, I almost envy them, because that means they have so much more time for games. Like, there are so many great games that, you know, keep coming out, but that are already out that you barely have touched. And it's, if you can break away from that hype cycle and just enjoy the amazing stuff that's out there, not only will you game for cheaper, I think you'll also be happier, because your expectations can't be false for a game that's been out for a year, where the expectations have been real, you know, are very real as to what that game is at that point.
All right, well,
you're not constantly caught in the whole comparison. I mean, think about it right now. If you're paying attention to, like, videos just the other day, we had this, I don't know if you watched it, but The Order did a very quick Twitch stream. So if you watch that, that game looks really great right now. Like, that little, it was only like a 3-minute demo, but it was like in-game action. It was like, wow, this looks freaking next gen. This is really nice. Or, you know, if you're caught up in the Destiny hype, like, you, how can you then sit down and play a game that you're going to be like playing today and not feel like, oh, I'm thinking about this other thing?
Well, it's a good time actually to thank our sponsor. DLC is brought to you today by MailChimp. MailChimp means easy email newsletters. MailChimp helps you design email newsletters, share them on social networks, integrate them with services you already use, and track your results. It's like your own personal publishing platform. You can customize your newsletter sign up to match your brand. You can share your sign up on your website and your Facebook page. It makes it easy to collect signups. You can do it from an iPad or a laptop. You can even import existing email lists no matter the format. Personalize what your subscribers see, including signup forms and confirmation emails. There's never been a better time to try MailChimp with their entrepreneur plan. Ooh, la-ti-da, maybe you're an entrepreneur. If you have under 2,000 subscribers, excuse me, I'll say that again. If you have under 2,000 subscribers, you can send 12,000 emails per month forever. Just visit MailChimp.com/5x5 to learn more. That's MailChimp.com/5x5. The easiest way to talk to a whole bunch of people at once, send out your newspaper. People don't read newspapers. They want newsletters via email. It's the easiest way to talk to a whole bunch of people all at once and get your message out there. MailChimp.com/5x5. And we thank MailChimp for supporting DLC and hope you support them in return. We have lots of games right now out. So let's go to the playlist. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us on the playlist. I know I've been playing a ton of games this week. There's lots of new releases to talk about. Garnet, tell me what you've been playing. What's on your playlist?
Well, I mean, I don't want to bore people because I am on a number of podcasts and I have been, you know, full speed on getting the last story finished. And I am about an hour away from finishing it as of last night when I decided to take a little break before going to bed. So, I mean, I can tell you guys how much awesome there is in the last story, and there is much awesome in the last story.
So last story is a Wii JRPG, right?
It is. It's a action-based Wii JRPG. I mean, it was done by Mistwalker, which was Sakaguchi's group that he put together. It was one of the last games. It might even have been the very last one that they got produced. It's just, I think the thing that stands out to me the most about it is how well the characters and their stories work together as a whole, as a narrative whole. And, you know, it's funny, it stays very much in fairy tale mode. And by that, I mean that the point plot, the plot points step through a fairly predictable path. But there's something really great about the predictable path when the characters are fantastic and you really enjoy them and the story goes together so well. And even the actual, you know, just the prose is really good. Just the way the localization was done, the whole thing just goes together is really great. And as Soshi pointed out, it's coupled with a battle system that is really quite fun. It's an action RPG, so you have control over one character. There's a little bit of clunk in that you have to build up a meter in order to command your allies. And there are times when you really need to command your allies to ensure that they don't use the wrong elemental affinity and actually help the enemy. But on the whole, most of the time you're using your main character to attack, control the battlefield. It has a cool system where your mages can cast spells that create a sphere or a circle of influence on the ground. And then you with your main character can diffuse that. And by diffusing it, you cause an effect. And that effect could either be to heal everybody in the party or to break the guard of all your enemies or to have a big fire attack. So there's lots of different ways to combine combo systems so it keeps the action flowing really well. And I actually, so someone in the chat just said they don't like the art. I would say I love the art and the style of the game. Definitely it shows the age of the Wii. But, you know, sometimes also when you're just really enjoying something, you know, you can see past that. There's plenty of people who play retro games and enjoy them, and you know, high-res graphics aren't the be-all and end-all of everything.
Well, speaking of retro games having awesome graphics, I'm just going to jump right in and talk a little bit about Super Time Force, because I didn't get a chance to talk about it last week. We were running long. Super Time Force. And it's awesome. I mean, it breaks my brain. It's this crazy mashup of a really intense 2D action platformer in the vein of Contra. But it's got that kind of level of intensity and kind of brutal, kill you a lot stuff. But it's mixed with this almost puzzle element from something like, what was that game that the whatchamacallem gentleman did? Mr. Something's Time Emporium? God, I can't, my brain. I swear, my brain. Anyway, the idea is that if you die, you can rewind time and start again with another character or the same character. You have this team of three characters that you can choose from that all have different abilities. And when you rewind time and start again, the life that you just lost still plays out. So if that life killed something, that thing still gets killed. If it grabs a power-up, that power-up still gets grabbed. And then when it dies, it kind of stops, but you can keep going. And if you kill the thing that killed it before it gets killed, then it doesn't die, and it turns into a power-up, and you can combine your powers from those two characters and become harder to kill and have a better super attack. On top of that, it's got the thing that I hate the most in games, which is the timer counting down. So, it's not a game that seems to be right for me, because every single level has this timer counting down. But the timer is only there so when you manipulate time, it adds this puzzle element of having to stack actions on top of one another so that you can accomplish everything needed to get to the end of the level in time. Because some of the levels, if you just ran from end to end, you couldn't even do it. You have to stack to actions. You have to have one life where you go and you unlock the door and then die and then rewind and have your other life run through the door as your first ghost life is unlocking the door, and so on. And it gets really intense and really crazy. It's a Cappy Games game, so you know that the pixel art is going to be superb and the music is going to be superb, but it also has a really wonderful sense of humor in the cutscenes. It's a game that's easy to recommend. I've been having a blast with it. Been playing it on Xbox One. So that's just one of the myriad games I've been playing this week. Christian, you've been playing Wolfenstein: The New Order, right? So have I.
Yeah. Oh, man. So I had money set aside for Watch Dogs. That was going to be my game of the month. And then I had some people that were playing Wolfenstein and had played it early. And I was like, you know what? I know the type of gamer I am. I'm going to be comfortable and confident with that type of gamer. And I am so glad I got Wolfenstein. It is right up my alley. First I'll get the biggest knock about the game out of the way, in my opinion. Some people have complained that the guns don't feel as satisfying when you're shooting them, like dual wielding automatic shotguns. And I think they could have a little more oomph. I think Call of War as Gunslinger had some of the best feeling guns I've played in recent memory. But man, the way enemies react to getting hit, I mean, it's mature rated, it's violent, it's over the top. But like the blood splatter, like the mist coming off of guys is awesome. Like the physics when they get hit is fun and funny and fun to play with. And so I think even the biggest knock people have had against the game, I don't think it's that big of a deal. And the game itself, it's I think closer almost to a BioShock than, you know, what you might remember Wolfenstein 3D being. Like, and it's in an alternate world where the Nazis win World War II and take over, and you're, you know, BJ Blazkowicz. Going through this world and experiencing things for the first time and coming to grips with things. He's a little bit of a sourpuss, but that's okay. I could understand why he would be. And it's cool. The alternative fiction is cool. The little Easter eggs, if you read the memos, are really cool. I think the story is a really refreshing throwback to like owning it. Like, this is a video game. It's kind of comic booky. It's a little over the top. The characters are archetypes often, where it's like, you know, this is the chick in charge and she's, you know, gets down to business, brass tacks, and BJ's the muscle. And oh, you're here. Now we can win this. The odds are in our favor. He's one dude. But it's like, and now we have the guy that can help us win the war. And you're one guy. Power, it's, you know, ammo everywhere. You're collecting ammo off of people. It seems kind of very PC-ish in that way, like a computer game. Not politically correct. And, you know, you're picking up health kits that are laying on the ground. The movement of the speed of the character feels more akin to a PC style game than a lot of console movements recently. And I think the character designs are great and interesting. I can't say enough good things about this game. Jeff, are you having a great time with it, or do you disagree?
I'm pretty early on. I'm a little ways past the very late title card that happens in this game. It's about, I would say, almost 2 hours in before the title card happens. And I'm just a little ways past that. So I'm still pretty early in the game. The Wolfenstein series, I look back and realize that I have played and completed every game in the Wolfenstein series so far, which is, you know, it's a storied franchise dating back to the beginning of first person shooters. I really loved Return to Castle Wolfenstein. I think that was one of my favorites in the series. And I will probably play and finish this one. It's interesting to me how it really does feel like a mashup between really, really old school shooter. I mean, this is a game, as you said, where you have to push a button to pick stuff up, where you're, you know, like in all the old Wolfenstein games, you're looking for secret things that are around the corner, little goblets, chalices of gold. You don't regen your health. Well, you do a little bit, but mostly you don't regen your health. You have to, you know, pick up health packs and pick up armor, and you have to push a button to do so. It feels very old school, and it really is a pure shooter. It just wants you to blast stuff as Blazkowicz. But it also has this very modern storytelling, which is, it's an interesting juxtaposition between those two things, because it's got this really cliched main character who is, you know, a throwback to the old Schwarzenegger Stallone era of action movies. But it's also got a very modern sort of nuanced sci-fi tale to tell about this alternate history and kind of the ramifications of Nazis and all that stuff. So I'm liking it. I don't think I'm as enthusiastic as you are quite yet, but maybe I haven't gotten into the real meat of it. It just feels like if you really want a shooter, then this is a shooter.
What kind do you, so keeping it vague. I mean, do you just kind of have regular guns right now?
Yeah, I know as in all the Wolfensteins, there will be some awesome, cool sci-fi stuff coming. But yeah, I'm still in regular gun area.
According to John Davison, Jeff, that part where you got to the title card is not like the rest of the game, which is awesome.
Okay. See, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah. That's what I'm thinking.
It's not unlike it, but that's kind of, when I was playing that and I was like, well, this seems very gray. This is fun, but I don't get it. And then, I mean, it doesn't go to Crazy Town. It just goes to Awesome Town.
Yeah. And he was surprised at how slow and how long that part was. He's like, wow, after that, the game got into gear.
Yeah. I'm expecting
it's
that.
It's a slow burn, but I really, really can't recommend this game enough. If, you know, not if you're a Madden player and you love sports games, obviously don't pick this game up. But if you like first-person shooters, if you enjoyed BioShock, I think this game like that has a cool, you know, what if dystopian future kind of world setting to it. I think it does a really good job building the world. There are newspaper articles that, you know, and some of them talk about, oh no, England's being overrun or whatever. And then in a totally different level, in a totally different part of the game, maybe an hour later, you'll see an article and it's like it's the German side of that same event. Or if you hadn't read the first article, the second one doesn't quite have the same context, but it's the exact same event, but it's written now after this country has been taken over by the Nazis. And it's like, and on Celebration Day, the Nazis, you know, we came through and the citizens were so excited. And it's stuff like that, that I think, like the action is great and fun, but then you have these little moments that are like they put in the time into this game. And I mean, I think if you look at the pedigree of the people that made the game, coming from games like The Darkness and Riddick, that's always been things that they've done. And so if you enjoyed those types of games, you know, it's an easy recommend to pick up. It's a lot of fun. And while it too is a cross-gen game, you know, it's not the prettiest graphics in the world. I'm playing it on PS4, but I think it looks great. Like, I've had no problems with stuttering or screen tearing or anything like that. I think it's played really smooth and I think it looks really pretty.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't scream next gen to me. I'm also playing it on PS4. Another thing that occurred to me while I was playing it is, you know, I really like, in theory, the idea of these games using the colored controller light to indicate your health, which Wolfenstein does. But the design of the PS4 controller makes it so you almost can never see it. You know, it's slanted out. It's like a flying buttress. You know, it's a slanted out.
It's not for you. It's for head tracking.
Right, exactly.
Right?
So, so
it's a cool feature.
But. It doesn't ever help you know how much health you have. It seems silly to me, but, the reason that I didn't play more of that game, actually, is because I was completely wrapped up in playing Transistor. Did either of you guys play Transistor this week?
No, I'm so dying to play that
game. Oh, it's fantastic, aren't it? You're going to love it. It's so good. It's so smart and so different. And, you know, it's the Supergiant guys who did Bastion. And I consider Bastion one of the best games of last generation. I absolutely adore that game.
And Jeff considers Bastion one of the best games of last gen.
I do.
He now talks about his experience with Transistor.
thanks, narrator guy. the concepts introduced in Bastion, I think this is the sort of next progression of them. This is very much a pseudo sequel in my mind. It really, I mean, although it's very different in a lot of ways and story wise, it breaks a lot of new ground. It really incorporates a lot of the things that I love from Bastion. The idea in Transistor is that you're in this sort of hackable world, and as you defeat things and sort of figure out what the story is, you acquire new powers through these upgrades, these hackable upgrades into your sword, into your system. And the crazy, crazy, almost mind-bending element is that each of the upgrades that you get works as both an active upgrade and gives you a power, you know, like a really powerful slice or a sort of area effect attack or you know, ricocheting off walls or whatever. But it also works as a secondary upgrade to an existing attack. So every single action that you can do works on its own, but also works as a bonus for something else. So it has a primary effect and a secondary effect. So your loadout of the four major skills that map to your four face buttons can be so different, because you can use all these different actions that you get, all these different attacks you get, and modify them in so many different ways. So you constantly have to decide, well, is this going to be my primary attack, or am I going to use its secondary effect to modify an attack I already have? And so you're constantly fiddling with your loadout and figuring out what kind of play style works best for you. And it also has the thing that Bastion had, which it adds these limiters to make enemies more difficult or create obstacles for yourself to do better in exchange for getting more experience points. So you're adding this dynamic challenge that changes depending on how good you think you have gotten in the game. So instead of just selecting, you know, easy, medium, hard, whatever, you're dynamically going, well, I'm going to make the enemies faster and that'll give me a boost to my XP, or I'm going to make the enemies have more life or whatever, just like in Bastion. It's brilliant. The fiction is really interesting. The game is vibrant. And I haven't even talked about the coolest thing, which is they add this amazing turn-based option. So while you have what is ostensibly a third-person action game in the vein of Bastion, a isometric top-down button masher, you also have this option with a refillable meter that lets you pause the game world and select a series of actions to take until your meter runs out. So you immediately feel wildly overpowered, because as soon as any enemy, even a boss, is about to smack you, you can pause time to have your character run around behind it and smack it a bunch of times before time even unpauses. So you feel like this awesome power, but you have to mitigate it, because once you smack them a few times, you're kind of vulnerable while your meter recharges. It's brilliant, and I think you guys would love it.
So what I wanted to ask about, Jeff, is the combat. What extent are you pausing and smacking, as you put it, versus what percentage do you think are you doing what I would describe as like real-time combat? Is it mostly the pause and go? Because I feel like I've heard it gets pretty intense. Like, I don't know if you can beat it.
No, I think that the game really wants you to do the pause and go. I think that's really the primary way the game is meant to be played. And she, the character you're playing as, she has this gigantic sword that you keep upgrading, and it's so heavy that she has to drag it around the levels. And she's really slow to use it, and you can leave yourself exposed if you're just trying to smack them around, you know, in real time. The game really wants you to do the pause and go, but it's a really satisfying system. So it's something you want to use as well. I do wish that it was more optional, in the sense of I wish you had a viable way to survive without using it, but I like it so much that I tend to want to use it every time my meter fills up.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, it's I mean, man, Bastion is such a great game, and this game looked amazing. It's just, again, so many games, man. So many games.
But,
the art, I think, looks so beautiful in this game, which is something that, again, they have done before. It's no surprise, but it looks really cool.
It drips with style. I mean, there's so much density of information and the whole, like,
oh, will it ruin my receiver then below my PS4?
Yeah, you don't want to have anything that's can be broken with water, because it drips with style. Halfway through continuing the joke, I gave up on it and was like,
I should have given up on it before I said it, but hey, you know, whatever.
Garnet, tell me about Heroes of the Storm. I want to play
Heroes
that.
Of the Storm. I want to play that. Welcome to the MOBA Lite, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You guys, I'm really interested in how everyone will respond to this game as it continues to grow in the number of people they let into the alpha and eventual beta, because I have been sitting on the MOBA sidelines for a long time, and I was doing that because hearing about, you know, directly from a number of people who play them about how much struggles they had getting into the game, I spent my time when I would have been playing a MOBA watching people play MOBAs and, you know, let's plays and also tutorials of how to get into them, especially LoL, because I figured I was going to go down the LoL path. Although the more I looked at LoL, the more I thought, well, maybe I'm really going to go down the Dota path. And then Heroes of Storm came along, and feeling, you know, fairly confident from having at least built myself some understanding about how to play MOBAs. I hopped right in, and it's been a interesting, if a little bit mixed experience. I'm not sure that a MOBA works as well when you start to reduce elements of its complexity as a card game does. Mm-hmm. Because this is just it. So far, I mean, admittedly, it's technical alpha, and they're calling it a technical alpha because they're working on the back end part of the game right now. So they're building up the server structure to negotiate games and how they connect players. It's not that it's, you know, technical of the game, it's technical of the service that runs the game. They have the game at a spot where they were happy with it. They've moved into this technical phase. They will be going back to playing with the game. As a matter of fact, they have a patch coming up where they will be altering the game some. And the initial part of the game is very fun, is playing with the Blizzard heroes is, of course, immediately a great connection. Mm-hmm. And so you have a lot of fun with that. And the unique elements that they bring to the game really highlights the, you know, the key element of a MOBA, which is that much like, so MOBAs are definitely sports. So much like a sporting team, the different players that you choose to bring into the arena really have important roles and have different roles that they play in the game, and you need to know how to play them. In other words, right. You can't go onto the football field as a tight end and try to play linebacker, or you can't go right. onto the field as a linebacker and try to play halfback.
Right.
So you need to still be in that mindset while playing heroes, and that really works. And it pushes people to play together. I mean, keep in mind, they've called it a brawler, and it pushes people to have that brawler experience with these map events. And I'm not completely sold on the map events as they're implemented right now. So if you're not familiar with this, there's three maps that are in the game right now, and each of them have something that happens on a global map scale that allows the one team to win, quote unquote, the power up of the moment to attack the other team. And these are very powerful. So for instance, in one of them, you go into these mines and you kill the denizens of the mine, and that yields you skulls, and each team collects skulls, and then the skulls are used to power a giant demon that attacks the enemy. Right. And if you win, and this one is at least balanced because at least there's an attack back and forth and you both get one. That's the closest to them being balanced. The other two have global events that just punish the other team. And typically what I found so far is that if you win the first one, it puts the other team in a really horrible situation from which it can almost not come back. And then if the second one, which most likely will go to the team that won the first one, gets one, then in all sense, the game is over. It's very difficult to get that momentum turned back around and going your way. And having watched a lot of Dota and League of Legends, I think one of the things that's really amazing is if you're good at that push and run dynamic and managing different lanes, you can still be in the game way after it. You know, it's much longer to develop. And it's not that the games last a lot longer, because a good Dota or LOL match is still over within, what, half an hour or so. So it's not really that those games are that much longer, but it feels like you're in it much later in those games because there's still a better opportunity to bring it back. Another thing is in Heroes, you can very easily be successful just pushing one lane. And so, you know, if you haven't played MOBAs, MOBAs are set up where you have a base on either side of the map, and there are lanes, and the lanes are essentially the paths that lead from your base to the enemy's base. And typically there's three of them. There's a map in Heroes that has two. And in Dota and League, you need to be aware as a team how you're handling and managing all three lanes. In Heroes, you can very successfully get behind one lane and just push the hell out of it, run into the enemy's base, and be pretty successful with that sort of attack strategy. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is, I mean, one of the key pieces of League of Legends and Dota is this idea of last hitting.
Yeah.
And last hitting is, and there's actually a number, like there's a bunch of part here that works into experience. You tell me if I'm getting like way too in depth.
No, it's good.
But last hitting in MOBAs means that, you know, you need to score the last hit that kills in order to reap the experience from that kill. Mm-hmm. And so then it also brings in the denial where an enemy can kill before you're able to make the kill and deny you access to that experience. And that's really important because in those other MOBAs, your character is leveling individually.
Right.
In Heroes, leveling. You're leveling as a team. Yeah. And this also seems to be like it's on the first blush. You're like, oh, that's a cool idea because it means the team's all working together.
Well, kind of evens out for less skillful players, right? Because they're not lagging behind.
Well, yeah. I mean, I suppose that's part of it. I mean, the idea is also that, you know, I think that people would feel like, oh, if I'm playing a support character, I'm still going to be carried along by the success of my melees up front, right? The downside of this, though, is that when the group falls behind, the entire group falls behind and you have no one around which to try and anchor a push to get back into the game. Oh, and so, again, here, same thing. When you see it, when you're playing a Heroes of the Storm match, if you fall, if your team falls a couple of levels behind the enemy team, then suddenly you have a real problem because your heroes are not capable of standing up to their heroes.
And there's not even a guy. There's not even a less powerful guy on their team to pick off. It's their entire team.
Right, and you don't. And conversely, you don't have a powerful guy who can go in and try and tip balance in your favor.
Interesting.
You're just all low leveled. So you're on. And typically, this starts to set in as you get over 10, right? Yeah. So you know, the first few levels you're racing together. But then, if you have a player on your team who makes a mistake or two and yields the other team a lot of experience by, you know, being, maybe they're a little too squishy. Maybe they are risking or not playing right, or, you know, they just get in trouble. So they give up themselves as a couple of kills too many. And suddenly you're only at 11, but your enemy team gets to 14. Well, you're hosed. Mm-hmm. Because now not only can you not stand up to them, but when the world event takes place, which brings everybody together by force, you really can't stand up to them. So not only does the team have a level advantage, they also have the advantage of being able to capture the world event. And so it just makes the game not have that back and forth sway that if you've watched, like, if you watch great League of Legends or Dota matches,
there are
so many oh shit moments where things teeter back and forth, and that seems to happen really early in Heroes, and then it just sort of falls away from there. I think there's a lot of ways they can balance it. I think that they'll do a lot of that. Keep in mind, this is a alpha.
It's a long way from being final.
There's a lot of potential in the fun here. It's very easy to pick up. It's very easy to get into play. The way that they have already sort of structured their early on part is that they just give you 3 skills for your hero until you reach like level 7 or something. And then you can get the additional skills that they have available to them. So then, you know, after you understand how to use QWE and fire off those skills, then they're like, oh, well, by the way, we're also going to give you skills that go on 1, 2, 3, and 4. And you're going to have to figure out how to run your player. Yeah. But, you know, I agree with Sosie to a degree that I trust Blizzard to fix issues and that they can make a great game. I'm unsure how much they can do so if they stick to a rigid idea of we're going to make a simplified MOBA.
Yeah.
That's my question. I mean, to some extent, it seems like if some company came in and said, guys, we did it. We made a simplified Dark Souls. You're welcome. And it's kind of like, well, no, the thing we like about it is all the complexity and figuring it out. And I mean, I feel like, are they taking football and turning it into flag football played indoor, where it's like the same game, but it doesn't have the depth or the complexity that people like I feel like
that's not even an accurate reduction. I mean, you'd have to take out play calling or something.
But the retort is Hearthstone. I mean, I think that if you had said, hey, we're going to make a less complicated Magic the Gathering, people would be like, well, what we like about Magic the Gathering is it's complicated. And it, you know, it seems to have worked for Hearthstone. So,
I think what the bet is here with this is almost, oh yeah, you love Dota 2 and you're a hardcore Dota 2 player. Great. Okay. It's very popular. League, super popular. But there are millions of people that haven't touched any of these. And if we can get all of them, we'll
win.
I agree with that.
So I wonder if it'll be a gateway drug, because having played it now, I sort of am more eager to try out Dota or League.
Yeah, I think that's great. I'm hoping that is the case. I'm... As soon as I finished Dark, it's funny that you brought up Dark Souls, Christian, because as soon as I finished Dark Souls 2, which I think I'm pretty close on, I think I'm going to try to learn Dota. I've found a Jedi Master that might be able to help me. So,
Jeff, if you, Jeff, came back and visited you, Jeff, from a year ago, I don't think you'd recognize you, even if you didn't have gray on the side of your hair.
It's a Wolverine reference, right? That's...
Oh, I thought you were just old and had gray in your hair now.
Oh, sad. yeah, I'm anxious to get into the MOBA thing. Dark Souls 2 has changed my world. It has changed my world. I have much more excitement for these deeper experiences.
They need to come out with a new edition so we can get that on a box quote.
There's a couple of games that I played at pre-E3 week that came off of embargo this week. They didn't before last week, so I didn't get a chance to talk about them. But I just want to briefly mention the fact that Civ Beyond Earth is phenomenal, and I can't wait to play it. I know you're a big Civ fan, Garnet. Earth, I got to play... You know, it's not really fair when you sit down and you play. Oh, we get 30 minutes with the game. It's like, oh, really? I can't even scratch the surface of a Civ in 30 minutes. But I did play enough to recognize that even in the first, 10 to 15 turns, the game feels very different than Civ, and it really has its own identity. Because you're playing on this alien planet, and I feel like the creepers in the game, the alien guys that are just wandering around, basically the equivalent of what barbarians were in early Civ matches, act and impact the game in very different ways than the barbarians ever did. They're much more of a presence, and the barbarians were just around to sort of stomp down and move on, and the aliens are, you're constantly interacting with them. You constantly have to decide whether you're going to attack them or not. When I first started playing, I was like, oh, these are kind of like barbarians. They're wandering around. I got to kill them off. And one of the devs is like, you don't have to kill them. You can live in harmony with the aliens. You don't have to just smack them down. And in fact, if you do smack them down, there's going to be repercussions for your early game. So you got to really know what you're doing here. The tech tree is wild and interesting and different, and it's all this future tech that is so interesting. There's just so much to digest. I'm really excited to get a deeper play experience with that game than I had in just 30 minutes, but it had a fantastic first impression.
And they didn't announce that it was online only, and you couldn't play with your Civ was limited to a small Civ?
No, it's not Sim Civy.
I feel like they've done a great job with this from announcement to rolling out. This is, I think, and you teased it earlier, a good example so far of announcement, hands-on release, like building a obtainable hype before release. Yeah.
I also played Evolve at the same event, the 2K event, and with a bunch of new characters. It still looks pretty darn cool. I don't know how much of a I don't know. I want to see more of this game. I want to see new monsters, and that's the thing they have not shown yet. I suspect E3 will be the big place where the monsters have a coming out party, but they did show a bunch of new hunters, and it's going to be that kind of thing where, like, you have all these different options of what kind of hunter you want, and they're the classes of hunters. You know, you have your assault, you have your medic, you have your trapper, and they all have variations on those themes, and you have to have one of each in your team. So it's going to be cool to see, like, oh, there's some choice to be made in which trapper I want to play as. But what I'm really interested to see is the new monsters.
I'm glad it got an October 21st release date in North America. And I, in terms of the window they were hitting, I think that's a nice time for it to come out. I got a little nervous when they, holiday was floated around, and it was kind of like this game could potentially be easily overshadowed. But to be in that larger holiday window, October is a nice early point in that, where hopefully they'll have a little bit of a week or two maybe of being out before the Call of Duties and everything start hitting.
Yeah, high hopes for that one. Very high hopes, and it looks pretty fun. It plays pretty fun already. So cool. Looking at the clock though, I notice that it is now tabletop time.
Tabletop time. Tabletop time. Tabletop time.
Right now. So way back on episode 5 of DLC, we had Tom Vassell on as guest, and he mentioned a game that he had just gotten his first hands on, and it wasn't even released yet. And it got me salivating. It's a game called Marvel Dice Masters, Avengers versus X-Men, I think. And I finally got a copy. I have to thank, oh my gosh, his name is not written down here. I screwed up. But you know who you are. I'll thank you next week. And he sent me you can't find these. They're sold out everywhere. The starter packs of the Marvel Dice Masters. And I was so happy to receive this in the mail from a listener. And I apologize I didn't have your name on hand. But I'm so grateful for it because I finally got a chance to play it. And it does live up to the hype. Marvel Dice Masters really does feel like Magic the Gathering meets Quarriors. If you don't know what Quarriors is, it's a game actually available on iOS that you can check out. But it's basically a dice building game, and where there's a bunch of deck building games that use cards to build decks as part of the game. Whereas you build a deck in Magic the Gathering before you start the game, but during the course of playing games like Dominion and Nightfall and Ascension and Thunderstone, in those games you're building the deck as you play, by spending cards as currency to purchase new cards to bring into your deck. Well, Quarriors did that same type of thing, but with dice. So you're, instead of building a deck that you play out of, you're building a bag full of dice that you then will reach into, pull out a few of, and roll for certain attacks. And sometimes a side of the dice will come up as currency for you to buy more dice. And sometimes a side of the dice will come up as a character. So the character side of the dice will reveal how much an attack it has, how much of a defense it has, and certain special abilities it might also have. So Marvel Dice Masters combines those two ideas. So you are playing stuff out of your dice bag and you're buying new dice to put into your bag, but you're also pre-constituting certain cards before you come into play that are yours and yours alone. In typical dice building games or deck building games, there's a community pool that everyone has access to purchase things out of, to add to your deck or add to your dice bag. But in Marvel Dice Masters has some cards like that, but most of the cards you'll be playing, most of the very powerful superheroes that you'll be playing, are yours and yours alone. So they aren't part of your dice bag when you start play, but they are part of the potential pool that only you can put into your dice bag. So I can start the game with Wolverine and Storm and Cyclops and the Hulk, and my opponent can start the game with Thor and Doctor Doom and Mr. Fantastic and Spider-Man or whatever. So you constitute the deck based on how you think these different characters will complement one another. And then as you play, you start with a few sort of dummy dice, little sidekick dice that hopefully will generate you enough income to purchase those heroes that you brought with you, to put them into your bag so that then you can bring them out of the bag and do real damage. And the way you do damage is much like Magic the Gathering, where you will place characters into an attack field, and then it's your opponent's responsibility to have blockers that he assigns. So it's not like Hearthstone, which is... it doesn't include that kind of back and forth dynamic of, okay, which guys are you going to block with? It's basically, you know, in Hearthstone, it's just I'm attacking, and if you have anything with taunt, I have to attack that. Otherwise, I get to attack whatever I want. In Magic the Gathering and in Marvel Dice Masters, the second player, the defensive player, gets to choose how they want to defend, whether they want to have multiple characters defend one attacker, etc. Which I think works really well as a tabletop game because it involves more interaction, which is the benefit of sitting across the table from someone. So here's my thoughts about Marvel Dice Masters. First of all, it's a ton of fun. It really melds those two different game styles together in a really fun way. The custom dice that constitute the bulk of what you're buying in these games are awesome. It's all six-sided dice, D6s, but each character has its own little symbol that is related to the dice that they use. So it's, you're getting custom Marvel dice with each purchase, and the bonus packs are only 99 cents. So you get a card that shows what those dice do, you know, the special abilities that might have. And then you get these custom dice that are super cool. Everything is really high quality and not too expensive, which is really cool. The game plays really fun, but I have a couple of major gripes. First of all, it's built around this collectible card game idea, like Magic the Gathering, where you're trying to get the rare cards. And there's multiple versions of all the heroes and villains. So there's like four or five different Wolverines. There's four or five different Hulks, et cetera, et cetera. But each of those cards, the different cards, are the same artwork, even though everything else on the card is different. It's got, you've got,
oh, that's
a, it's bummer. A major bummer. It's such a bummer, especially when you have this wealth of Marvel art.
Yeah.
And I think it ruins the collectability of the cards. Like, yeah, they're collectible because they're rare, but literally the only thing that shows you that it's rare is a tiny strip of color that shows, you know, the color being the indicating the level of rarity. And then, you know, it has like a little, I don't know, like a subtitle. So it's Wolverine, you know, best at what he does, or Wolverine, you know, whatever. And those change, and his powers are different on each card. But it would be so much more collectible if the card looked different and had cool artwork on it. I mean, it does have cool artwork, but different than the other Wolverine that I already have. It's very frustrating to me.
Yeah. And that could be, I mean, I think cool too when you have it out. It's much more immediate to see, oh, I've never seen that. Oh, can I look at that? You know what I mean? Like, even just shopping the card, or when you play the card or have it out.
Part of the collectability is like you said, is showing off the cool thing that you got, that you bought the pack and you got the legendary edition. And it's like, well, no, this is the legendary edition. See the little text there? See the little text? It says he's different. It's such a bummer.
If you squint and turn your head 90 degrees, oh, nice. Nice legendary, bro.
The other major bummer with the game is that the way that the game is laid out is very important. There are different areas where you place your dice that indicate to the opposite player what you're intending to do. So if you push your dice into a field that indicates you're going to do an attack, or if you spend those dice in a certain way and they get knocked out, then you have to slide them over to the knockout area. And it's really important that I, when I'm playing you, know exactly where your dice are sitting, and you, playing me, know exactly where my dice are sitting, and it's all very clear. Which is all well and good, except that even the starter set, the only play field that it comes with is like the center portion of the rules. So it doesn't come with a play mat, which is kind of required for you to play this game. Now, to their credit, if you go on their website, you can print out the play mat for free, which is what I did. But who wants the crappy, like, printed out version on a piece of 8.5 by 11 paper? You can't really make use of the rules as the playmat because, A, it's in the center of the rules. So every time you want to check a rule, you have to pick it up and move your dice and, you know, look through it and then place it back down. And B, you need two of them because there's two people playing. So they are going to be selling these playmats at a certain point, but they're not available now, which is really annoying. So what I did, I found on Board Game Geek that these guys have pre-made templates for you to buy. There's sites that let you buy like custom mouse pads. So I bought a custom mouse pad with that image on it to use as a playmat. But it's so annoying that I have to do that and I don't just get it with my starter set.
Well, especially if the ultimate goal here is, you know, another way for them to make money and monetize the game, you'd think they'd want those playmats out, even if they're not included in your starter set, and that's a legitimate gripe. But you think they'd have them out along with it so that they could get that money, because instead, now you built your own, and what are the chances you'll buy an official one or whatever?
Well, with
you know?
Me, it's probably pretty good. But most people... Anyway, true. This is a game I really want to play with both of you guys because I think you would dig it. It's only a two-player game. It's a, you know, total 1v1 versus like Magic the Gathering is. But man, it's really fun when you earn enough income or whatever you want to call it to put the Hulk in the game and he can just freaking smash and all of the effects that each of the characters have is very much indicative of how their powers work. Like they did a really wonderful job of imagining like what would Storm's power do? How would that affect, you know, the play field, and how can we express these characters' powers through the mechanics of this game? They did a really wonderful job of that. I think both of you guys would really dig this game.
Yeah, I'm down. I like the way you finally get it when I'm gone for half a week. No big deal.
Sorry, dude.
As long as I'm second on the credits, I'm okay with it.
Garnet, you were playing Cards Against Humanity. That's a tabletop game.
That is a tabletop game. I mean, it's a little, that is a little old school, isn't it? We were having a lot of fun with it. One of my friends, they have the bigger, blacker box, and it's like the most incredible, it's the most incredibly huge collection of Cards versus Humanity cards I've ever seen. It's a bit daunting, actually, but it is great because you get a better, you get such a great, you know, overwhelming selection.
Yeah.
It's sort of funny to get like the different currents that run through their card creation. So you like, you can hit a wave where you're like, oh, this is where they were putting a lot of celebrities' names in.
Yeah. Yeah. Which are like the least exciting cards to get when you're like, oh, I got Michael Jackson. Really? I got to wait to use that one.
Depends on how they're used.
Sometimes.
It depends on how they're used. You know, look, the reality of that game, the trick of that game is knowing the people you play with and knowing how to tickle their funny bone, not necessarily the table's funny bone.
Do you actually play that game by the rules, and do you play it to win, or do you play just to create some fun?
We play it more just to have fun. I mean, we sat down and play, and then we just sort of play for a set amount of time or until you know, someone's amount of cards run out, and then whoever has the most tricks wins.
Yeah.
So yes, there is a winner. I mean, there's always a winner, but you know, it's not really a big deal. The winner is us who got to play the game.
Exactly. Yeah. Classic party game. My only gripe with that game is the cards that require two white cards. You know, the black cards that require two white cards has two blanks on it.
Yeah. Why is that?
Because there's always this thing of like, okay, place the first one down first and the second one down second. And then you can't shuffle up the cards and you have to it's a lot of mishigas that I don't think it adds anything particularly.
Sometimes those two-parters can be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Just going to say sometimes those two-parters. So, Jeff, since you're stretching tabletop a little bit, I want to say, have you ever thought about adding books to the show?
I would love to add books to the show. They don't really fall under the gaming heading, but I could talk about books forever.
I got to give you a couple of proppers on the Stormlight
Saga. Oh, you're reading it?
Well, yeah.
Stormlight Archive, but yeah.
I finally finished the first book, which is, by the way, a massive.
Well, they're both massive. Yeah, it's going to be a massive series. It's 10 books, proposed 10 books, and each of the first two is over 1,000 pages so far.
I should live long enough. But I'll say this. So I just want to say this about Stormlight, because it took a little bit to get going, as they all do. But I've read Eddings and Jordan and Tolkien and Martin, and that is the best massive first book ever.
Nice.
Especially the wind up, because about halfway in I was like, okay, this is really good. I'm really enjoying all these characters. I was looking at how long it is. I'm like, okay, I'm gonna take a little break, because the second book just came out here this spring. I'm like, okay, I'm gonna take a little bit of a break, and then I'll read something, you know, palate cleanser. But then the last third of this book went like, I love that in the first book of a massive series, he put his foot on the accelerator and just like stomped it all the way to the floor with what's going on with the characters, what's accelerating with starting to bring together the pieces. If you're comparing this to like Game of Thrones, which is big right now, it's that Game of Thrones, you know, splinters off into all of these characters, and it begins to get burdened by, I want to keep up with all the characters, but they're so diverse. Whereas here, he introduces, you know, let's say three core lines in that first book. And before long, you start to see how they could potentially come together. And then by the end of the first book, you can see where they are converging. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of strings he pulls in the very first book where you're like, oh, crap, that's huge. And I love that. And so I finished the first book and immediately went to my Kindle desktop and bought the second book and started reading the second one. I was like, okay, amazing. Yes, it is Brandon. So yes, it's Brandon Sanderson's books. And I suppose I could look up the name.
The Way of Kings is the first book. And
there you go.
Words of Radiance is the second book. I think the best thing about those, though, I hope you agree, is the action sequences are awesome. It's
phenomenal. So gripping and well written. Like you get into one of the combats and you will not put the book down.
It's
here's how you bring these up, right? It's tabletop time theme plays. So what I want to talk about is, you know how Settlers of Catan sometimes can have a slow burn before the game really gets going? That reminds me of Book X. And what's fascinating about, and then you talk about Book X for however long you want, and the combat is amazing, like Marvel Dice, whatever. It's great.
I love how you're doing. Done. Whatever. It's all this crap that Spicer cares not for.
Hey, Christian, it's Mark again. If you're going to say the name of the game, could you at least make sure the game's right? We sent you a style guide that comes with all the information. Okay, great. Love the podcast. Bye, guys.
Hey, if we're talking about books, though, I got to take a second and plug my audiobook that is now out. You guys, I can talk to you. I can read a book to you in your ear holes. I would love for everybody that's listening to this to check out my audiobook. I didn't write the book. I just read it. It's called Traveling in Space. It's on Audible right now. It's on iTunes. I think it's on Amazon as well. It's by Stephen Paul Leyva. I was just up in the Bay Area yesterday for a BayCon. We kind of did a reading and debuted it. But it's a science fiction book. It's really funny. It's fun. It makes you think. I'm super proud of the work that I did in reading it, and I genuinely like the book. Like, I'm not blowing smoke. I think it's a really awesome book. It's a first contact novel of aliens meeting humans, but it's told from the perspective of the aliens. So it's like the aliens going, what are these weird humans that we just encountered as we were flying through space? Really smart, really clever, fun turns of phrase in the book, a really unexpected plot. I think you guys would dig it. So check that out.
Yeah, I listened to the sample. It's solid voice work on that sample. There are a lot of characters that you get to play into, and it's
thanks,
great.
Man. I did over 35 characters for the book. Yeah,
that's crazy.
It was a lot, but I'm really proud of it.
None as realistic as Mark, though. But that's okay.
Mark is a fully three-dimensional creation that you have. I like he's Mark from marketing. His last name is Edding, right?
Yeah, Mark editing from marketing. Love it.
Oh, recurring characters you'll find here on DLC. One of those
I'm putting my SNL audition together.
One of those recurring characters, of course, is Garnet Lee, whom we have to thank for recurring on our show. We love having you here, Garnet. Thanks a lot, buddy.
Thanks so much.
Tell the people where they can find your stuff if they want to hear more.
Oh, you know, guys, just follow me on Twitter at Garnet Lee, or the show that I do, Garnet on Games, at Garnet on Games, which is also up on Shout Engine. It's on your favorite, you know, wherever you get podcasts, RSS reader, whatever, everything and anything. Listen to us. Listen to the show I do with John as well. Just, you know, enjoy games and be part of the team.
Live in the now.
Live in the now. Now gaming.
Where is your now including now, Christian?
Right now it's thunderstorms in Houston, Texas, where you know you're there if you see girls in skirts and cowboy boots and stars stuck on sides of houses. I'm trying to think where June is crazy for me, man. I don't even know. I'm Twitter at Spicer, and my Nerdist podcast, if you want to hear like some stand up talk and not dumb one liners or Mark from marketing, I might try to bring him over though. I do a show called What's New with Christian Spicer. It's on the Nerdist Network. People seem to dig it. Split Cider, which is a big comedy website, called it a must listen. So that's kind of dope. And of course, this show. Hey, if you listen to this show, tell your friend about this show and rate it on iTunes. Even if you don't use iTunes, do it. It helps. It sounds silly. Like, why would I do that? Because it helps us, and you like us, and we like you, and stuff like that.
Excellent. Thank you all for listening. You can find more of my stuff if you follow me on Twitter at Jeff Cannata. That's with two N's and one T. Or jeffcannata.com, or my YouTube page, youtube.com/CannataJeff. You know, I always end the show every week the same way. And this week, as an alumni of UCSB, it is even more close to my heart that I don't want the way I end the show just to be a catchphrase. I hope people listen to that as men, and I'm sure the majority of our audience is men. I think we can all do better, be better people, and think about what we put out into the world and make it a better place.